Okay, so welcome back everybody, and I hope that you've had a really lovely rest and been nourished fittingly and plentifully by your lunch. And we thought that sometimes teachers call this the graveyard shift, because if you haven't had a rest, you might be feeling sleepy. So we thought we'd give the main Dharma reflection at this time every day to keep you awake and hopefully bring a little bit more inspiration to your practice. So I had a few thoughts for this talk, and it's been going around my mind because partly my biggest interest in the suttas is to understand how suffering leads to joy, because I guess I came to the practice through a sense of quite heavy suffering. As I said yesterday, for no particular reason other than the way the world is and the suffering I would hear about in the news, etc., etc., and that I would feel within myself. But it's interesting that the Four Noble Truths are framed as suffering and the cause, the uprooting of that cause, and the path leading to freedom from suffering. Because you could equally frame those Four Noble Truths as happiness. Happiness and the cause, the things that get in the way of happiness, and how happiness is brought about. And the Buddha did talk about Nibbana as the highest happiness. So the path was known as Sukha Patipada, the path of happiness. And it's a bit like you want to plant a beautiful tree full of sweet, juicy fruit. You have to start with a seed that contains those same qualities. You can't expect a beautiful sweet mango to come from a neem seed any more than you can expect a neem fruit to come from a mango seed, right? And so in a sense, although happiness is the goal, the path is also a path of ever-increasing happiness. And it can start from a place of less than that. Thank goodness, because I'm sure, I don't know, maybe some of you have got what you came for already. I don't know, and that's if you leave, that's why. But most probably you've got aching knees and you're feeling tired and sore, and it's like, this isn't quite what I thought it would be. So today I wanted to talk about the necessity of happiness and the type of happiness that the Buddha encouraged us to pursue. So happiness is something real. Pleasure is something important on the path. And it can be trained. It's not that we either have it or we don't. Unfortunately, like Burnett said yesterday, we do tend to have this negativity bias. It's almost as though the soil in our brains or in our hearts is more fertile for the weeds than for the flowers. But luckily, the path helps us to till that soil through a process of mindfulness and wisdom, and also discern what is a weed and what is a flower, and how to water those flowers. So happiness is important every step of the way, but especially so in meditation, and especially when we come to the deeper stages of meditation. And pleasure, sukha, is actually the proximate cause for deep states of calm. But it's a pleasure born of peace, not a pleasure born of excitement. And this is where the difference lies. And that kind of pleasure, when it starts to arise in meditation, as Burnett also said earlier, it can be almost like the glue, if you like, or the nectar, perhaps, that keeps the mind with the object of meditation. Yeah? So in every kind of method of meditation, whether you're working with the breath, or you're working with metta, or you're working through bringing up the goodness in your lives, they tend to go through certain stages. At first, just getting aware of the terrain of the mind and aware of your object, getting to know the breath. You know, maybe connecting with the phrases of loving kindness. But at some point, the mindfulness builds and it takes you through a stage of what's called piti, which is when rapture starts to arise. And the rapture is a kind of, is born from sustained attention, and it keeps you close to your object effortlessly because it's so attractive. And so when this starts to arise, the process just happens quite naturally from there. And it's just getting it started that can be the trick. So it can also be a beautiful inner resource, the kind of happiness of meditation, that cushions the mind so that if insight does arise, It doesn't shock you. It doesn't break you. I've been practicing for about 28 years now, starting in India and then ordaining in Myanmar and reordaining, taking the full ordination in Australia. So I've had many, many teachers and also seen many people practicing the path. And sometimes when insight is emphasized too early in the process, you know, things like the Four Noble Truths, the truth of non-self, that there's actually no one in here kind of at the control, or even the truth of impermanence. We can get a taste for that, but it's also quite a challenge. It can be really quite unsettling for the sense of self. And it's important, I feel, to enable the letting go by having something more to let go into. Because if we try and let go of everything we hold dear, in essence, our identity, our sense of self, all the people that we feel are ours, right, that we love, that we own, and yet we don't have another resource within ourselves, it's very, very frightening, and it can make the mind rather brittle. So when we develop happiness along the path, all the way from the beginning, we gradually let go quite easily. It's almost like you're weaning off an inferior kind of happiness onto something much more sublime, you know. And in the same way a child might cry when you take away their toys, once they become, you know, 7, 8, 9, they're not interested in those toys anymore. Now they've got books, now they've got literature, or later on they have friends that they can engage with in a meaningful way. And so it's not distressing to put down those toys, right? It's just a natural part of growing up. And in the same way, we have to learn to allow the mind to mature in a way and refine itself, tune in to a more sublime, a more enduring, reliable source of happiness and pleasure. So I wanted to talk about happiness from the perspective of the suttas, and the Buddhist teachings on happiness and pleasure can be broadly categorized into two analytical schemes. So this is very helpful because it helps us understand what to develop and what to leave aside. So first of all, he differentiates between wholesome and unwholesome happiness. Right? So for example, there's the happiness of sense desire and there's the happiness that's free from sense desire. Which one do you think's best? There's the unworldly happiness, I'm shifting it around now to confuse you, and worldly happiness, similar. There's the happiness of sensuality and the happiness of renunciation. Yeah. And I'm sitting here as a nun wearing the robes. I don't know, do I look miserable? Sometimes. But, yeah, renunciation for me came about through a gradual process of letting go of an inferior kind of happiness, not with any kind of moral condemnation, but simply because there was something more refined. You know, it's a little bit like when you're young as a teenager listening to Led Zeppelin. That was my thing. And later on, that's all a bit kind of grating on the mind, so you start to get into classical music. And later on, when you start to meditate and you start to go inside the mind, and if the mind has got some beautiful qualities, then the silence is even more profound, even more alluring than the most beautiful kind of music you could hear. So the Buddha said, you know, again, not with a judgmental kind of attitude, but he said that the first type, the sense desire, is binding, it's agitating, it's something not to be developed or pursued. And an analogy that I really like is like drinking salt water. You're thirsty and you want to have something to allay that thirst, but all you know is water with salt inside. So of course you drink it, you know, thinking that this is going to help to some extent, but after one glass you're still thirsty. You have to drink more and more and more. And a little bit like with, you know, binge-watching television or kind of scrolling endlessly on Facebook, eventually you get pretty sick. You get a big headache, you think, why did I do this to myself? And you realise that although you were longing for something to alleviate the pain, this actually led to more suffering in the end and probably some sleepless nights. Whereas when we find the other kind of happiness, which is essentially the happiness of the mind, yeah, that kind of pleasure is like drinking beautiful, fresh mountain spring water, just flowing from a freshwater spring. And the more you drink of that, the more refreshed you feel, and it gives you the energy to carry on along your way, carry on along the path through ever-increasing states of happiness and peace, the happiness born of peace, all the way to the freedom of release, to enlightenment itself. So the kind of happiness the Buddha praised was actually the happiness of the deep meditations, and he had names for those kind of happiness. First is the happiness of seclusion, paviveka sukha. And that actually means to be completely secluded from the sensual world, even the world of thoughts about that world. You know, how many times do we meditate and we feel like we're away from the world, but then inside our mind, we're still thinking of the chocolate cake that we can have like in the local cafe when we leave, or all the movies we're missing, or whatever it might be. We're still obsessed with those thoughts, or maybe it manifests as a kind of obsessed mind towards the body, the health of the body, whether you're going to permanently damage your legs by numbness or whatever. You're not. I don't think anybody ever kind of caused their leg to die by letting it go numb for half an hour. So don't worry about that. And then the next kind of happiness was called the happiness of renunciation. And these are all descriptions of the deep meditations, the jhanas. He also called them the happiness of peace, upasama sukha. And actually the happiness of enlightenment, sambodhi sukha. Because it's not enlightenment, but it's a very similar kind of experience in that it's born of freedom, it's born of letting go. So there are two differences there. The sensual desire is something that's more coarse and agitating, and it's of the world, whereas the happiness of meditation is actually moving away from the senses into the bliss of the mind. Yeah, and that is much more calming, more freeing, and it actually leads to letting go. In fact, the Buddha said that is to be pursued and developed, and it's not to be feared. In fact, the only possible outcome of these deep meditations, if you practice them long enough, are the four stages of enlightenment. So sometimes people think that we can get attached to those kind of pleasures of the mind. But if they're born from virtue, if they're born of letting go, born of a kind of peaceful happiness, then actually there's no danger at all, except you might lose your hair, even at a young age, by becoming a monk or a nun. Who knows? So obviously, if you think about the happinesses in your life, you might not have experienced those states yet, but just think about times you were really happy, times you were really content. You know, were they states of high excitement and agitation? Was it a kind of hot, burning kind of happiness? Or was it cool and content? I don't know how it was for you, but I know for me, I started to get an increasing taste for the cool and calm kind of happiness from the mind. So once we've distinguished between these two types, the next analytical scheme that we find in the suttas is the progressive refinement of that wholesome happiness. And of course, we don't start from those deep states of meditation. Sometimes we start from suffering itself. And this is how suffering as a cause for happiness makes sense. Because actually, if we can come out of a narrow perspective on suffering, you know, this is happening to me, it's something wrong in my life, it doesn't happen to anyone else, and we take it personally, we kind of sometimes withdraw, even from our closest friends, you know, we just kind of shut down and become lonely and depressed. And then, of course, it's like adding suffering to the suffering. The Buddha called that the second arrow. The first arrow is the pain of life itself. You know, you've been shot with an arrow, it hurts. And the second type is you add anger to that. You add this, I don't want this, this shouldn't be happening, something's wrong. Or this only happens to me. I think that's one of the most painful thoughts, isn't it? When we think it's, you know, only happening to me and no one else understands this. And that's like adding another arrow, which hurts even more. It's the emotional or psychological arrow, if you like. So this is how suffering builds suffering. But when we see suffering in the context of the Eightfold Path, it's actually part of right view. This is the first factor of the Eightfold Path, the eight steps, if you like, to happiness. So here the Buddha's contextualizing suffering into being something universal, something actually inevitable and a part of any existence, and especially perhaps, not especially the human realm, but I think in the human realm we're more sensitive to it and we have the capacity to understand and make meaning of it as well. Yeah. So it might be a more complex kind of suffering we experience, especially the psychological and emotional stress, but it's actually a beautiful existence to be a human being with the faculties to observe and to understand. So when we see that universality of suffering, it can give rise to this beautiful sense of compassion, a widening of compassion and concern for all living beings. And that's including those beings who cause and perpetuate harm. Yeah. It's not only that we have compassion for people that we like, that we approve of, who behave in beautiful, noble ways, but we can also start to have compassion for those who inflict an enormous amount of suffering on others, intentionally or not, simply because we know there must be hurting inside. Yeah. When we're happy inside, it's very, very hard to create misery for others. Most of the time, it's our moods that affect one another, isn't it? When we generate negativities or, you know, we start to think in ways that are pretty uncharitable towards ourselves or another person. This is when we start to suffer. But when we have that sense of the pervasive nature of suffering, we put more care into the quality, the ethical quality of our actions, of body, speech and mind. And this becomes already a source of softening of the heart with compassion that connects us to one another in this human plight. And it becomes the foundation, if you like, for an ethical life. And the Buddha said that, you know, virtuous qualities of the body, virtuous acts of the body or speech, or virtuous qualities of the mind, are sukha vipaka. That means they have a happy consequence. Their result is happiness in the mind. So is virtue fun, or is it a drag? I don't know what you think. But recently I was on an interview for Radio BBC 4, World Service actually. It was quite cool because they wanted to know about the monastery that we're developing in England, the first of its kind for women who wish to train in monastic life towards full ordination for the sake of hopefully full awakening, to give them that possibility for the very first time. So they had me on there. And there were two other teachers who were fantastic, really inspiring, all working in their own field of Buddhism, very contemporary and accessible, and representing a diverse range of genders, sexuality and race. But one of the things another participant said towards the end was that they like to have fun. And no, what was it? They like to... It's important to be virtuous, but they also like to have fun. And I felt a little bit too shy to interrupt, but what I really wanted to say was, aren't they one and the same? I mean, being virtuous is fun, right? The first payoff is you have lots of friends. Even animals are not afraid around you. Even animals come close because you have this sense of harmlessness. They can trust you. And they feel that just in your sort of immediate aura. Very mysterious, but we do affect each other tangibly in that way. So virtue is fun, and one of the first qualities of virtue is also that it leads to a confidence and an inspiration in the path. You know, you try it and it works. You get more inspired to follow the Buddha's teachings. You try the teachings a little bit more, you maybe establish a daily practice, or you have a gratitude practice, or, you know, maybe get familiar with rousing the good in your mind before you meditate. And all these practices have results. And so that gives you inspiration to take the next step and the next step. And because of this, you have patience. You know it's a matter of cause and effect. If you cultivate the right seeds, they have to bear fruit. It's only a matter of time. So it gives the heart patience, it gives it courage, and it gives us a great enthusiasm to train and to find out if it's true that happiness really can be trained, can be, if you like, hardwired into the brain in neuroscience, this is the terminology they now use, and they found that you can actually change your brain through the way you use your mind. So in the suttas, virtue is not only spoken about as something to refrain from, you know, refraining from unwholesome deeds, but it's also talked about as positive action. Action, again, that brings about more kindness in this world. So not only do we not kill living beings, and I'm sure none of you here intentionally do, but we actually go about protecting the life of living beings. And the language is very evocative and beautiful. This is, for anyone interested, in the Majjhima Nikaya number 51, and I think also in 125. In both of those suttas, it says, with rod and weapon laid aside, merciful and compassionate to all living beings. So this is beautiful imagery, you know, that we can conjure up to encourage us to really take that extra care to preserve and protect all life. That includes ourselves, because virtue always has to be, you know, acts of body, speech and mind that do not harm others or ourselves. We are one of among many, and that's again that universality of the path. The Buddha also talks about using speech that goes to the heart. Not just kind of random chit-chat, but speech that uplifts. And speech that divides the, that unites the divided. Because often there are so many divisions in our society, so many divisions among people who used to be friends. So we, instead of talking negatively about somebody behind their back, sometimes we might need to point out a difficulty that we have with a person, but the motivation needs to be in order to understand and come up with a resolution and come up with some tools, perhaps, to foster harmony that's been lost. And then, of course, instead of stealing, we practice generosity. And generosity in the Buddha's texts, is talked about as an adornment to the mind. It beautifies the mind and also prepares it for the practice of calming the mind and the practice of insight meditation. And of course, being loyal, being trustworthy, you know, whether you're a partner or a friend, you keep your commitments. If you say you're going to do something, you do your best to fulfill that promise. So people can rely on you. People feel safe. Yeah? And we don't take intoxicants. Even if we think, you know, it's a bit of fun, it's harmless. Once you start to really value a clear, bright mind, then you want to protect and preserve it at any cost. Even if it means having to say to your friends, not tonight, I'll have a juice, you know. It's okay, sometimes they don't want to be drinking either, you know, but they're just doing it because the next person is. If you do it, they'll be like, oh, maybe I can do the same, you know. I also don't have to have this stinky, yucky stuff that gives me a headache and, you know, causes me to be without cash for anything else. So these are some of the beautiful ways. And also livelihood, right? We can try to find livelihoods that are wholesome, you know, that provide for ourselves and our family, maybe the local monastery as well, you know, so that we can give to charities, not only for us, but we can do that without compromising our integrity. We can do it in a way that we feel brings value and meaning to our lives and serve society in a meaningful way that's values aligned, you know, so that your practice on the cushion is no different from the way you act and behave in life. So all of this leads to what the Buddha called blameless bliss, anavajja sukha, one of the first happinesses you find on the path. And this is because the hindrances are being weakened quite significantly. You know, in order to keep virtue, a little bit of restraint is required. We can't always give in to our desires. Sometimes we have to say no. And that gives a kind of confidence and strength and power to the mind. And it gives us a sense of blamelessness. We quickly find the hindrance of remorse is overcome. We don't sit down and start regretting things we've said or things we've done. And that improves mindfulness as well. And then we learn to take this virtue inside our mind. This is a mental aspect of virtue. It's called sense restraint or guarding or governing the senses. And this is learning to use the senses, you know, the eyes, the ears, the nose, the, you know, all of these senses that we have, the body, in ways that leads to the wholesome states increasing and the unwholesome states decreasing. So it's again a process of watering the flowers And if you like, neglecting the weeds. You don't necessarily have to pull them up and kind of go after them, you know, like some kind of gardener on speed. You can just leave them aside, okay? The weeds will be there, you know. We have these very fertile minds for weeds and we've been cultivating them. So they are there, but if you then turn your attention and your sunshine of loving kindness and the moisture of compassion, turn that to the flowers, then those flowers start to grow and almost smother the weeds. So one example of this is, you know, sometimes we don't always feel happiness in life. And for me, working on the project as I do is a very tiring job. Often I'm up at kind of too early, really. I want to sleep in, but I can't. And then I'm working, I'm engaged with people and with emails and with all kinds of business from 7 a.m. till 11 at night. It's a bit like that old Led Zeppelin song for anyone who's old enough. Working from 7 till 11 every night, anyway, can make life a drag. But in my case, I learned to tune in instead to the underlying motivation of my mind. And the underlying motivation is to bring about more Dhamma in the world, to serve Dhamma, you know, to give of myself, to share the energies of my life in the hope that I can create more conditions for others to experience some of the life-changing, you know, experiences and insights that I myself have had. So even though my path is far from complete, I can still share what I have along the way. So it's a matter of just inclining the mind slightly differently. There's a beautiful place in the suttas that talks about three wonderful monks who could easily be bhikkhunis, who could easily be nuns, but unfortunately men usually write the history books, so it's often phrased with stories from the monks. But these three monks were some of the Buddha's favourites and ones he really held high as an example that he said would continue to inspire us even into today, even, you know, thousands of years ahead, and so they are. And the reason that these three monks were particularly inspiring was the way that they related to one another. And it's said in the suttas that they regarded one another with kindly eyes. I really love that phrase, kindly eyes, because it's something that we can learn to internalize too. Can we regard ourselves with kindly eyes? You know, our mental states, our behavior patterns, our idiosyncrasies, someone was asking about that word, our kind of conditioned tendencies or traits that may be a little bit sticky, but hey, they're part of you, you know. Can we regard them with kindly eyes? And these three monks as well, they used to really tend to one another as though they were three in mind. What was it? Three in body, but one in mind. And another beautiful thing they used to do was to bring up a reflection, even while they were alone, thinking about the qualities of their friends. So they'd say, you know, to themselves, what a great gain it is for me, what a great gain to be living with such virtuous companions in the holy life. So the sila starts to be internalized. We don't only say this to people face to face, but in private also we can start to think about people in ways that uplifts our mind and that really notices and appreciates their beauty, their qualities, the goodness in their hearts. And then you'll find when you meet people in real life, you tend to be much kinder and they tend to respond differently to you. So all of this sila, all of this virtue, is a way of overcoming those coarse hindrances. And in the gradual training of the Buddha's teachings, this comes before we go to the forest or the foot of a tree. And this is interesting because by the time we go into our meditation, we're supposed to have a little taste of blameless happiness, of the happiness of sense restraint, which is called unblemished happiness. Also the happiness of contentment, another part of sila, another part of virtue. The happiness of simplicity. We're decluttering our lives, we're decluttering our minds. Yeah? And also the happiness of wakefulness. So the mind is starting to brighten up, so that when we sit down cross-legged or leaning on that tree, leaning on your chair, whatever it might be, you're comfortable not only physically but also mentally. You're comfortable inside. There's a sense of gladness about your life, gladness about you know, all the blessings of your life, because you've been looking at them all day long. You've been reflecting on them. You've been cultivating them and not taking them for granted. And so this sila improves and refines the quality of the mind so that when we sit down to meditate, there's an absence of remorse, but there's an attitude of gentleness, of kindness, and also an attitude of non-harm. Yeah, these are actually the three right intentions that the Buddha praised. The last one, actually, gentleness, is similar to non-harm. It's the avihimsaka sankappa. It literally means non-harming, which, or non-cruelty, which is a synonym for compassion. So there's kindness, there's the compassion, and then there's the attitude of letting go. And for people who might find that difficult to understand, including myself, I have to say, because I find the word let go is quite an imperative. And for me, it's more of a process. So I instead like to think of letting go as a kind of giving, yeah? A kind of looking for what you can give rather than gain. And this is one of the right motivations to practice. If you're looking for what you can get, you're always going to be looking for some fantasy. A phrase that my teacher says, which I think is very profound, is you look for what's there, right in front of your mind. You don't look for what's not there. You look for what's there. You don't look for what's not there. Yeah. So we're looking at what is right there with eyes of kindness, with eyes of acceptance, if you like, and, you know, contented with little. And when you stare at something like that, or when you look at something, let's say, you regard something with such kindness, it starts to soften, it starts to glow. It's almost the difference between looking at something with a hawk-like gaze, you know, the hawk that wants to land on its prey. We see a pain and, you know, I'm aware of you. And you really zone in. That's too hard, it's too harsh. And it tends to solidify the pain, right? Because if you're looking with hardness, then what you see is going to be a little bit hard as well. So instead we take on these kind of grandmotherly-like eyes. You know, imagine a grandmother kind of just sitting back from her grandchild, watching them play, with kind of playful eyes, with a sense of curiosity, a sense of warmth. Can we be more like a grandmother, you know, and regard our inner experience with that kind of playful, curious sense? In neuro retraining, there's this concept of neuroplastic pain. I don't know if anybody here suffers with chronic pain, but it's something I'm looking into. It's quite fascinating. A lot of chronic pain, up to 90%, is actually being produced in the brain, right? We used to think it's produced in the body, but what happens is that long after a physical injury is fully healed, the brain remembers that there has been a problem and keeps on lighting up those pain signals again and again, even though there's nothing wrong. So it's not in the mind, because the pain is real. The brain really is, you know, kind of looping in those pain cycles. And one of the most effective things to break that cycle is laughter, is fun, a sense of joy. Yeah. So can we be a little bit more joyful, a little bit more playful in our practice? You know, even just having a silly laugh. I'm sure that's why my teacher Ajahn Brahm tells terrible jokes, and you have to laugh just at how terrible they are. But it helps, you know, just a smile. And we can bring that smile inside the mind. I had wanted to get into the real blisses of meditation, and as usual, I've overestimated how much time I have, or underestimated. But just to go a little bit deeper, maybe for a couple of minutes, into the bliss that can arise through meditation. Again, it's learning to tune into a different kind of happiness, a different kind of pleasure. And at first you might not really understand what that means. You know, we close our eyes and, I don't know, it's kind of peaceful, but it's kind of dull. Does anyone have that feeling here? It's kind of okay, but nothing special. And we have this idea that bliss is the lights and, you know, kind of rapture coursing through the body. And that's not what's arising. But it's interesting. I was teaching a retreat in the barn about in December, and a couple of people had this complaint. They said, you know, they're sort of peaceful, but it's kind of boring, a little bit dull. And I said, are you sure? You know, what if you imagine that you're looking at your experience almost like having left a bright room and gone into a dark room? You haven't yet got your night vision. What if you just wait, you know, stay with the experience, respect it, give it kindness, just remain present, and allow the eyes to naturally get their vision. And you'll find at that point, you know, if you are peaceful but still a little bit dull, if you just wait with it and you allow all the energy to flow into the knowing part of the mind, don't start to interfere. That kind of breaks the whole process. But just allow the energy to build. The less we do, the more that energy builds in the mind. And energy is a kind of joy. So after a while, the joy starts to arise. And at first, it may be subtle. But again, if we can see it with appreciation and gratitude, almost within an instant, and this has happened to me so many times, even from states of distress, I've just managed to relate with a sense of warmth, a sense of kindness, a sense of making peace, stopping the war, making an armistice with the mind. And almost in an instant, it can shift. And suddenly this peace, this joy fills up the mind, and you know this is the joy of virtue. This is the joy of practice. This is the joy that happens when we start to let go. This is what the Buddha meant by a joy that's not to be feared. Yeah, because you're not making it. It's more like you're getting out of the way. So I think I should wind up here, but it's just to give you a little taste of how the practice can develop and to emphasize the importance of the qualities of our minds. So that, you know, we're not coming to the meditation cushion with a mind full of clutter, a mind that has so much sorting out to do. But we've already been like folding the sheets, folding the laundry in our cupboards, putting everything in the right place. So that when we open those cupboard doors, it's like, aha, here's the wholesome states. I can take one of these, I can take some of this. And you know how to navigate that mind. Yeah. So the whole path is about wisdom, mindfulness. Yeah, the wisdom and mindfulness that knows how to discern between the wholesome and unwholesome. And then the wisdom to allow yourself to cultivate that joy. Yeah, it takes a bit of wisdom. So, with this reflection, let's sit in meditation just for a few minutes to end the session.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.